Welcome to another episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast focusing on real-life SDN, NFV, network automation, and all those architectures and solutions that work in today's networks, not on some future platform that no one has seen outside of proof-of-concept labs. I'm Ivan Pepelnjak, usually blogging at ipspace.net, and we're back in Switzerland, the lovely home of SnapSwitch, an incredibly fast virtual switch, as you know if you've been listening to the pilot episode of this podcast. My guests today are obviously Luke Gorey, the brains behind the SnapSwitch, and Simon Leinen, an early adopter and OpenStack guru from Switch, the Swiss academic network. How are you today, guys?
Very well. Fine. Thank you very much.
And what are you doing these days? What are your projects that you're working on?
So I'm on a kind of a crusade to make networking very, very, very simple and make it much easier to build production network boxes. So I've come to this in a roundabout way. I spent about 15 years building networking products at various network equipment makers and startups. I took a detour doing research work with Alan Kay's group in California, looking into how to write device drivers in a simpler and nicer way. And I did some other work that influenced me a great deal, which was helping write firmware device drivers for the one laptop per child laptop with a guy called Mitch Bradley, who did all of the firmware and drivers at Sun Microsystems in the early days. So I'm kind of taking the strange ideas that I picked up in my travels and mixing them together and trying to build a really cool piece of open source software from them.
That sounds fantastic. What are you working on, Simon?
So I also spent 15 years on other things, in this case building networks. I used to be a backbone engineer at Switch at AS559. I tried to also build very simple networks in spite of everybody suggesting more complex solutions. But since 3 years ago, I've moved to a different group, and in that team we are building a cloud infrastructure, which is focused on infrastructure as a service offerings to the Swiss academic community. So I deal a lot with technologies like OpenStack or Ceph for storage.
So you are also a firm believer in making the networks as simple as possible, not as complex as possible.
Oh, yes.
It must be us old timers. We don't have anything to prove anymore. Anyway, for those people who haven't been listening to the first episode of this podcast, although we just told them to do so, in 30 seconds, what is SnapSwitch?
SnapSwitch is an open source program for processing Ethernet traffic from realistic traffic sources like 10 gigabit network ports. So it is a Swiss Army knife when you have designed some network element on a whiteboard and you don't actually have a box that does that thing and you want to roll up your sleeves and do a little bit of scripting and make it work and deploy it in your network.
So is it like a framework, or do you have pre-built building blocks that you can use to put things together?
It's both. So it starts as a framework, and we have a certain set of building blocks for I/O for various kinds of Ethernet interfaces to physical networks or virtual machines, and some packet processing bits, some packet processing elements that you can mix in and do interesting things with. But there's a lot of emphasis on making it easy to build your own, black boxes to do whatever it is that you want with traffic.
So if I want to do something with traffic, how complex would that be to implement? What language would I have to use, for example?
So if you're going to use the existing network elements that we have, then you are just going to write a configuration file that wires together some little black boxes. So suppose, for example, that you want to build a bump in the wire packet filter. Then you're going to take a black box, which represents a 10 gigabit network port, and you're going to create two of those in a config, and then you're going to take another black box that represents a packet filter, and you're going to wire them together. So you can imagine having a little chain of black boxes, a 10 gig interface that packets arrive on, then they go to a packet filter. If they pass your configured criteria, they continue on to another 10 gigabit interface, and they go out the other side. And if the packet filter doesn't do what you want, maybe you want to filter GTP encapsulated traffic on your 3G network and we don't support that, then you're going to write some Lua code, which is a kind of a simple scripting language that you should be able to pick up in a weekend or so to match the packets the way that you want and do whatever kind of crazy logic makes perfect sense to you and everybody else thinks is a bad idea.
That sounds like networking I know. So I can start with just taking the building blocks and in a configuration file defining how they fit together.
That's right.
And then I guess each building block might have its own configuration file that tells the building block, like the filter you just mentioned, how it should behave.
That's right. So you have a different sort of a palette of building blocks that you can use. You create an instance of one of these and you give it a configuration, which is peculiar to whatever kind of function it's implementing. And then you arrange these in a directed graph by connecting links together. So each one of your black boxes has a set of named input links, for example, one called Rx, and a set of named output links, for example, one named Tx, and you say how these should be connected together, and therefore what happens to the Ethernet packets that come in and out of the black boxes.
Oh, so it's also very simple to implement things like mirroring, for example.
Yes.
Huh, that sounds awesome. Now, how do I manage these configuration files? How do I edit them? How do you configure this thing?
The way that it typically works is, and don't get scared when I say this, but it's a little bit like Emacs. So your configuration file is a little bit like a .emacs file in the sense that it is actually a program. It's a Lua script that can do anything that you want. It can go out and connect to databases if you want to. But in the simplest case, it's just making a few function calls to create your little network and connect things up the way that you want. And to make things convenient, we have a kind of a built-in delta function where you can compute a new configuration and have it automatically update your network without interrupting the system execution.
Ah, so you can change the configuration in real time while the switch is running.
That's right. So it's like the old Unix style of creating a new configuration file and giving a sighup to say, you know, keep running, but use these new rules.
Now that you mention Linux, this whole thing is running on Linux, right?
That's right. In principle, we think of it as kind of being like a bit of firmware, like what you would find inside a physical switch running on an embedded sort of a processor. But it does actually compile down to a binary that runs on Linux and is pretty self-sufficient. So it doesn't ask Linux to do all of that much, but it at the same time, it is a user space executable that just runs like any other program.
So it means that you first have to write your own building block, for example, in Lua, or you write the config file in Lua and you use the existing building blocks, and then you have to compile the whole thing into code that is particular to your implementation.
Actually, it's pretty neat. So again, like Emacs, you know, so Emacs is very extensible and you can write a new mode to do some strange thing and you can kind of compile it in to a whole new thing, or you can just kind of write an arbitrarily complex configuration file. So it's entirely possible actually to have a config file that implements a whole new bit of functionality, even a device driver for a new network card or a new network protocol or anything like that, and just run it as a config file, although you can also compile a new binary that includes that.
Ah, so with the config file, you can load any source code you wish, which could include additional building blocks.
That's right. So you can also think of it a little bit like a web page, you know. You can recompile the browser with some new features, or you can just kind of do arbitrarily crazy things with a little bit of JavaScript in your web page. So our configuration files are a little bit in a similar spirit to that.
And if I would be crazy enough to include my building block in the configuration file, for whatever reason I don't want to recompile the whole thing, and that thing then gets into the data plane between two 10 gig interfaces, how fast would that thing run?
It would run very, very fast indeed. So we use an implementation of Lua, which is written by a very impressive guy called Mike, who lives in Munich. He is basically the best just-in-time compiler developer in the world at this time. So his amazing program called LuaJIT will take your script and trace its execution and convert it into x86 machine code that runs kind of as fast as greased lightning.
And you do that in real time while switching packets.
That's right.
This is bizarre.
Yeah, it is. It's a really cool piece of technology that has been used quite a lot in the video games industry. It's being used in financial trading. It's being described as a secret weapon for people doing high-frequency trading. And it's also being used in networking. So we're relatively early to the idea of deploying LuaJIT for networking, but the high-profile user is really Cloudflare, who are kind of dealing with hundreds of gigabits per second denial-of-service attacks based on LuaJIT scripts embedded in the Nginx HTTP server. So in many ways, they've kind of already blazed the trail in an HTTP context, and we're trying to do the same thing in an Ethernet packets context.
But still, I mean, I have to reiterate this. I am so impressed. So you could effectively implement a new protocol or a new functionality and then just restart your switch without actually stopping it or without even interrupting the packet flow. And this new protocol would be loaded in the switch and the switch would start using it immediately and it would be compiled and it would work at line rate.
That's right. So you get the same kind of, the same kind of design that you have with Emacs, you know. So text editing, it doesn't seem as hardcore in many ways, but it's the same principle. You have a program that has the capability of loading new code at any time, and you can just feed stuff in incrementally and make stuff happen.
Are you sure we are living on the same planet? Because this definitely doesn't look like the networking I know.
I know what you mean. It really is a huge departure from the way that networking is normally done, but it's kind of a part of a brave new world that has become possible since networking moved out of the Linux kernel and into user space. And now there's a lot of amazing stuff that's been done in user space during the last 20 years or something that has not been accessible to networking people working on Linux x86, but now is. So although this seems kind of like a strange thing that we're talking about, if you consider that you can go to a web page and find a JavaScript program that emulates an x86 and boots Linux in a matter of seconds running in your browser, you realize that strange as it is, this is the universe that we live in, and this kind of stuff has been possible for a while now, and we networking people are just a little bit late to the party.
Oh, mentioning that trick in the browser, I prefer the one that emulates PDP 11 and boots Unix on it, but that's a different story. Now, you mentioned user mode. The listeners to this podcast probably aren't all kernel programmers. So can you explain the difference between kernel-based forwarding, user-based forwarding, what you do that's different from Linux kernel, and why are you so much faster than Linux kernel?
Sure. This is actually a pretty broad trend that's been going on for the last 10 years or something like that. So 10 years ago, if you had a networking problem that you wanted to solve using a PC running Linux, you basically you had to do all of your processing inside the kernel, because when a packet arrives from the network, the kernel gets a copy of it and wakes up to do some processing, and the time that it would take to copy that packet up to an application in user space and do the context switch and all of this would just kind of cripple you. So everybody doing networking on Linux x86 boxes had to be an expert kernel programmer. And this is a black art. You're working in a very constrained environment, and you know, when you make a mistake, the consequences are very dire. And it kind of has meant that there's been a really high barrier of entry for people to do serious networking, say 10 years ago. And then an interesting thing has happened more recently, which is that hardware has got faster and faster, and networks have gotten faster and faster, where it doesn't make sense anymore to even use an interrupt, for example. So if you look at a modern networking application, you're expecting to get many, many packets arriving every microsecond. And if you would seriously try and, you know, wake up and drop everything and switch into the kernel to process each packet, then you'd just spend all of your time switching around on things. So these days in a networking application, you kind of assume that there is a continuous stream of traffic arriving just into memory from the network. And once you have that mental model, there's not any reason to be running inside a kernel anymore. These days, you just run a completely normal application. You could write it in Java if you want, or anything like that. And you just have an area of memory where a network card is blasting in packets, and you just need to kind of process them, treating it as a big array, and stick other packets in another bit of memory that the card is looking at to ship stuff out in. So if you were never interested in networking before, you can kind of ignore most of what has ever been done in the past, because these days, high-speed Ethernet networking is just done in the same way as any other kind of programming.
So you effectively map the interface card into the memory of a user process, and then the user process works directly with the interface card.
Right. So in our case, we actually write our own driver for the network card, because this is something that that I really like. We have a device driver for the Intel 10 gig NIC, for example, that drives a lot of advanced features like the embedded Ethernet switch that they've got built into the NIC, and the quality of service, transmission rate control, the multiple queues, and all of that kind of thing. And this is about 850 lines of Lua code that runs as fast as you can run, because everything is just raw memory.
Now that you mentioned the Intel NIC, do you support any other NICs? Do you work, for example, on AMD CPUs, or are you tightly coupled to Intel CPU and Intel NIC?
Right now, I would say that we're pretty tightly coupled. So we do run on other CPUs. Certainly, everything is just x86. But when we do our performance measurements, we're focusing on Intel Sandy Bridge and Ivy Bridge CPUs right now. And in terms of networking, we really are pretty focused on the Intel NICs now, although we are, for various reasons, adding support for other ones as well. But our philosophy is kind of to pick some hardware and do a really good job on that hardware, rather than to sacrifice quality for portability, because there's always a kind of a cost to portability.
Now that you mention performance, I remember we sort of met in virtual space when you tweeted me that you had an Intel server generating 200 gig of traffic. And
right.
You were so proud of that result. So how did you do that? How can you push 200 gig out of an Intel server?
Well, this is a very interesting thing, actually. So one day I sat down with the pen and paper and just thought about what the performance is on a modern PC these days. Because, you know, historically people have always said, well, you can't really do much networking with a PC. The CPU is too slow, and the memory is too slow, and the PCI bus is full of bottlenecks, and all of this kind of thing. And I don't have that diagram in front of me right now, so I might give slightly the wrong answers. But if you just look at the raw performance that you have on the hardware level, you can do something like 800 gigabits per second from your DRAM banks. You can do something like 600 gigabits per second of PCI Express these days. And your interconnect between the CPUs is also hundreds of gigabits per second. So there is actually no single limiting factor you can point to where you can say why you can't do something like a half a terabit per second with a completely normal, two-socket Xeon server. And once you realize that, you see that any problems that exist, and sure, there are problems, people hit performance problems at hilariously low traffic rates even, but you realize that this is a software problem, and it's not a hardware problem. And once you kind of take on that mindset, then you can just look directly at the hardware, putting all software aside, and say, well, okay, what can the hardware do, and how can you allow it to do that?
So you're saying that there is effectively that the only bottleneck is the CPU.
Yeah, and even the CPU is pretty bloody fast these days. So it really depends what you want to do. You know, if you're just kind of shipping packets in and out, then you can expect to do more than 10 million packets per second on one core. And these days you can have 24 cores if you want on a pretty basic server. And you can really parallelize things as well. So you have a tremendous amount of CPU power, although you have to be aware that as soon as you start doing even pretty simple things like accessing an unpredictable address in memory, you can easily lose an order of magnitude in performance. So it's not that you can run every application at these kind of speeds. But certainly when you think of the daily problems that people really have in network operators, for example, when they deploy a Linux-based firewall and it starts kind of blowing smoke and dropping packets at around, 3 or 4 gigabits per second of real internet traffic, this has been seen as a problem of PC hardware, but it's actually just a problem of software.
So as long as you optimize your code so much that it stays in the cache of the CPU, that you don't ever have to go out to fetch data from DRAM, you're fine, right?
To a first approximation, yeah. I think the list of performance landmines you can step on is actually reasonably long, but accessing unpredictable out-of-cache memory addresses is very high up. So basically, the hardware wants to run really, really, really fast. And as an application programmer, you just have to not step on any of the performance landmines if you can help it.
But still, how did you get 200 gig out of an Intel server? What did you do?
Well, okay, that's kind of cool, actually, because we did it using only about 10 or 20% of a CPU core in that case.
A single core?
So actually, for really high performance, we were using about 10% of a core on one physical CPU and 10% of one core on the other CPU. So this was a case where I really needed to generate a lot of traffic for testing, for testing a snap switch based application. And I didn't want to spend, you know, lots of money having equal amounts of, you know, load generation equipment as for the rest. And I realized, I'd been reading the data sheet for the Intel network cards on the bus, and I realized that you can kind of load them up with packets. And once they're loaded, there's an efficient way that you can just tell them to kind of keep doing what they're doing. So it turned out that actually I was on a small hike in my neighborhood, and I thought, you know what, this would be a cool thing to show Ivan and maybe get to mention on his Twitter feed. So what I realized is you can take a trace file, a PCAP file, read in about 32,000 packets, push those packets into as many network cards as you want. I happen to have 20 10 gig ports on the server that I normally use for testing. And then you basically just tell all of those ports to run in a loop and just blast out traffic. And you get a ridiculous amount of network traffic with the CPU doing almost nothing.
So you effectively preload the TX ring with 32,000 buffers, and then you tell the interface cards to have a go at it.
Exactly right. And if you're looking at what the hardware can do, it's actually pretty obvious, but it's the kind of thing that you would never think of if you were only thinking in terms of the software interfaces provided by existing drivers and that kind of thing. So I think you get new opportunities to do cool and novel things if you engage with the hardware rather than just looking at APIs.
Now, all you described to me so far looks very similar to how Intel's DPDK was described to me. So it looks like you're using the similar approaches. It's all user-based, user mode forwarding. There are no interrupts. You dedicate CPUs to serve particular interface cards. What are the differences?
So yes, you're right. It's very, very, very similar. So I'd say in principle, DPDK and our I/O layer, they're basically the same thing. But the intention is different. So we've implemented a really, really streamlined bit of code to support our own software design. So the overlap between our code and DPDK is probably about 1,000 lines of code. So if we would use DPDK as a library, we'd probably retire around 1,000 lines of our code for our drivers and that kind of thing. But the DPDK is like 1 million lines of code. So it's a much kind of big, heavyweight kind of platform designed for people. I would say primarily designed for people to port existing mature network applications onto. So DPDK is this fantastic savior for people who have a big application running inside the Linux kernel that, you know, that was engineered quite a while ago, but now really should be done in a different way, and they just port everything over to the DPDK.
So DPDK effectively replaces the Linux TCP stack, right?
Yeah, well, the whole of the Linux kernel, I would say. So 10 years ago, if you built, you know, a firewall or something like this, which is a great product that you're selling, everybody is happy, then you had to have engineered that to run inside the Linux kernel because it just was not practical to get performance in any other way. Whereas these days, for the kind of traffic levels that people expect in realistic networks, you can't be in the kernel anymore because the kernel has not kept up. Its basic overhead of serving interrupts and this kind of thing has become a liability, whereas it used to be an asset. So everybody who has a mature product needs to get the hell out of the kernel and somewhere else. And the DPDK is just the perfect thing for these people to port onto as a new platform. So I think everybody, all of the vendors who have been shipping networking boxes that are quietly running x86 inside, I think they're all very, very, very grateful to the clever people at Intel for giving them this fantastic toolkit that bails them out and gets their performance under control for the next 10 years or so.
You mentioned a few times interrupt-based processing that Linux kernel uses. And you are using, I guess, just simple polling. So you just check whether there is a new packet to process. And if there's no packet, you wait a bit and you check for another packet. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So we run in a really simple polling loop, and we run multiple parallel traffic processes on separate CPUs. So scheduling is also simple. You kind of say, I'm going to have 10 traffic processes. Each traffic process needs a CPU core, and you just give them each a core and let them do their thing so they don't even interact with the scheduler.
So you effectively burn one core per forwarding process, and that core is constantly checking whether there are new packets in like a polling loop.
In practice, yes. You can also let the scheduler do its job or use real-time priorities, but the way that we tend to do things is to, as you say, burn a core. Say, this network port gets the CPU core, and then just run things that way.
Because I guess everything else is too slow, right?
Yeah, well, it exposes you to a lot of unpredictability. So the Linux scheduler is a very clever kind of a program, but that's the last thing you want. You know, when you're trying to give consistent, robust kind of performance, and everything that I say here is straight out of the DPDK playbook as well. So this is kind of the new normal way of doing things.
Yeah, I know they do the same thing. Now, in the previous podcast, you mentioned that people also use SnapSwitch as a high performance NFV focused switch for OpenStack environments. I understand how you get the high performance when you are standalone on x86 box and you have your own core and you switch packets back and forth. But how do you get the high performance when you have to run inside the hypervisor and work with the VMs and the physical interfaces and all the stuff that's around there?
So I would say there are two key bits that I would describe there. One tricky part is doing fast I/O towards the virtual machines. So we focus on KVM, and historically they've only had a high-speed interface for talking with the Linux kernel. They haven't had an interface towards user space. So we actually did a whole bunch of hacking and added such a feature to QMU, and we're really happy that this is just getting merged into the mainline now, and will be in QMU version 2.1. There's a new feature called vhost user, which is a very high-speed, lightweight way for KVM guests to talk to user space switches. So that's a part of the puzzle.
Oh, so you removed the kernel from the forwarding path.
Yes.
Effectively, your user mode program is talking straight to the device driver on the guest VM.
That's right. So the guest VM sees this abstract virt.io net network device, but when it talks to the hardware, that actually becomes a Unix socket message to an external process, which for us is SnapSwitch, and then we set up some shared memory mappings, and then the VM is just looking in memory and seeing packets appear and disappear, and we're doing all of that work.
Now, for VMware people, the virt.io device driver is something like VMXNet 3, right?
Something like.
So it's a standard device driver that is not tied to any specific hardware that you can expect to find on any KVM environment.
That's right.
And that thing obviously needs to copy packets in and out of the guest VM from the buffers in the guest VM. And do I understand correctly that now you effectively map your user process to the same physical memory where the VM has the I/O buffers so that you can read and write them directly?
Yeah, so we've actually taken this to a quite absurd and extreme length, I would say. So the VMs are only able to address their own memory that they've allocated themselves. So a software switch cannot give memory to a VM. It has to use the memory that the VM already has. So what we actually do is for each VM, we go down to hardware in the NIC and we provision a separate transmit and receive queue in hardware that matches that VM. And then when the VM gives us a buffer that we can use for packets, we translate that kind of DMA descriptor from the virt.io format into the hardware format and just give the buffer directly to hardware. So it means when a packet comes in from the network, it comes to the NIC figures out which VM should get it by looking at the DMAC and the VLAN typically, although it has some other capabilities. Then it picks which hardware queue it can find memory belonging to that VM on, and it grabs a buffer and it copies the data directly from the NIC into the VM. And then our switch wakes up and just tells the VM that it has a packet without actually having to move any bits around.
So you're effectively not even in the real forwarding path.
Yeah, so we're in like we're forwarding just DMA descriptors. We're not actually forwarding any packet data in the normal case.
But that means that you need to be able to program the NIC with the mapping between the destination MAC addresses and the receive queues, right?
Yeah, and we're really lucky here, I would say, actually, because people developing NICs have done some super, super, super cool new features, like this SRIOV, which is essentially it's an embedded switch in the NIC that pretty much all cards support these days, where they can actually dispatch traffic in pretty clever ways across multiple queues. And traditionally, this is more or less ignored by software switchers. They say, well, hardware is, you don't want to marry yourself to one bit of hardware, or hardware is too limited or whatever, and they just implement everything in software. But we take another approach, and we try and geek out on the hardware and see what the hardware can do, and then do as absolutely little as possible on top of that with the CPU to achieve the desired effect.
Now, I was looking at Intel's SRIOV documentation because I thought about using that to connect the virtual routers, for example, straight to the physical interface card. And what they described was that you need to install a very specific device driver into the guest VM. Do you have the same limitation?
So we do not. So that is a big work area for us. We do this translation of descriptors so that the guest uses a completely standard VirtIO, and then we translate that into a hardware native format. So it means that although we focus on Intel NICs now, we can support any vendor, and the VM will never see the difference. The VM will just see the abstract VirtIO net interface.
So toward the hardware, you are using SRIOV so that you can get all the benefits of the switch in the NIC and all this receive and transmit queues. But then you turn around and you present a standard device driver model to the guest VM.
That's exactly right, yes.
Wow, this is impressive.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that this has been done elsewhere. I know that there are a lot of hardware features that seem to be targeted at exactly this design. But in the open source realm, at least, this is not the way things are done in practice. So we've rolled up our sleeves and done quite some hacking to make it work.
So effectively, you don't need any new device drivers anywhere. All you need is an Intel NIC in your physical server.
That's right. And so it means that going forward, you can use any hardware that you want. And hopefully it creates good opportunities for hardware companies as well, because anytime they can put features in the NIC that allow you to offload, for instance, OpenStack networking concepts down onto hardware, then we can support that in our driver. And even though the VM doesn't see any difference, we can offload work from the host CPUs and kind of increase the efficiency on the hypervisor level.
So I guess you are already doing TCP offload, right?
Well, yeah. NIC is doing TCP offload and the VirtIO is doing TCP offload, and we are just staying out of the way.
So you're like the translation engine that maps between the two.
Yes.
Now, talking about TCP offload, I know that most of today's NICs can't do that when you start using overlay virtual networking, because they cannot insert the new, let's say, VXLAN header in front of the TCP segment they slice out of the big TCP packet. So does SnapSwitch support overlay virtual networking, or are you just focused on VLANs?
In the NFV context, we have one specific use case that we go for, which is a protocol, a very lightweight Ethernet over IPv6 point-to-point tunnel. So it's not an overlay in the VXLAN sense, it's more like a GRE kind of thing. So that we support in the NFV. But in terms of the kind of sexy hardware offloaded things, one of the first things that we actually did was to implement the NYSERA standard, the STT tunneling protocol that specifically drives the hardware offload features to do efficient tunnels. So in one of our branches floating around, we have an implementation of that that was kind of initially a sexy demo that we did to show that we can drive the hardware offloads. And I guess it will dig up if we ever need to do an interoperability integration with an NSX, if they're still using that protocol.
Oh, they are, for the same reason you are. It's the only one that can give you overlay networks with very high performance.
Okay.
By the way, when you mentioned the Ethernet over IPv6 sort of GRE tunnel type implementation, how fast is that?
So that I have no numbers on yet, but that's a new implementation, and we're currently working our way through the code backlog to make all of our new features run fast, and that is towards the back of the queue. So ask me again in a few months.
Fair enough. Now, if I want to join the effort because I'm so excited about all these new features, where can I get the SnapSwitch?
So everything is on GitHub. You'll find the SnapSwitch page with a wiki explaining where you can find the people on the mailing list and how to get started, how to check out the code, how to build it, and all of that kind of thing. And then you would hop on the mailing list and introduce yourself, tell us what your interests are and what you might want to do with SnapSwitch, and kind of get to know the other people and what they're doing.
And I'll make sure to include all that in the show notes so that people don't have to Google around. They'll just have the direct links to use.
Great.
Perfect. Thank you. So, finally, where can people find you?
So, I live in a small village in the Swiss Alps, close to Grindelwald and Interlaken. It's probably quite hard to find me around there.
Okay, so Google Maps will help.
Right. So, most practically, it's probably best to find me by email on luke@snab.co, or on Twitter as LukeGo, LukeGo, or on the Snab Devel mailing list.
And Simon, where can people find you?
So I live in a slightly bigger village that likes to call itself downtown Switzerland or Zurich, and the Switch offices are pretty close to the main train station, so drop me a line and we can have coffee together in the office. I'm also on Twitter. The handle is Simon L, but don't expect too many tweets at the moment. We're very busy with building clouds for Swiss researchers, and I also have a similarly idle blog on blog.simon.linen.ch.
And I hope that when you start implementing those cloud things that you are now working on, that you will document them on your blog, right?
Yeah, I try.
Thank you very much for joining me today. I'm Ivan Pepelniak, and you can find me at ipspace.net or follow me on Twitter as @iOSHints. You want to know more about SnapSwitch, you'll find the show notes at podcast.ipspace.net, where you can also subscribe to this podcast. And if you want to know more about networking for cloud computing, you'll find a lot of resources at ipspace.net/cloud, where you'll also find some network-relating podcasts, webinars, workshops, and you just might find out that you really need is a healthy dose of webinars or a subscription. Finally, if you like the show, please do tell a friend, leave a review on iTunes, and follow us at podcast.ipspace.net.